record.
Well, let's start with a word of prayer, shall we? Holy God, we thank you as we gather this day. Lord, we are on an Advent journey. We are moving toward a great celebration of Christmas. Be with us and guide us on the way. Help us to prepare for your coming. Help us to be open to signs of your coming. Lead us in you. Be with us, Lord Jesus, for in your name we pray and ask it all. Amen. Well, we had a week off. Any questions or comments or things you've been wondering while you had your week off?
Yeah.
We're actually getting a little into our Christmas. We'll meet this week and next week, and then we'll take a couple of weeks off for Christmas. So we'll be a little haphazard here. But it's creative. So. Okay, yeah, we are up to chapter 17. Get my coffee here. Just a reminder, chapter 16 has been those bowls of plagues. In chapter 16, right at the end, John has said that Rome's going to fall. Rome's a goner. Now in chapters 17 and 18, John's going to go into a lot more detail about that. John's going to share more of his view of what the Roman Empire is like, what Rome is like, and he's going to share more of his view of what awaits Rome. So, kind of a laying out of what's already been hinted at in chapter 17. So, let me start out the first six verses of chapter 17. Then one of the seven angels who had the seven bowls came and said to me, "Come, and I will show you the judgment of the great prostitute who was seated on many waters, with whom the kings of the earth have committed sexual immorality, and with the wine of whose sexual immorality the dwellers of the earth have become drunk." And he carried me away in the spirit into a wilderness, and I saw a woman sitting on a scarlet beast that was full of blasphemous names, and it had seven heads and ten horns. The woman was arrayed in purple and scarlet and adorned with jewels and gold and pearls, holding in her hand the golden cup full of abominations and impurities of her sexual immorality. And on her forehead was written a name of mystery, Babylon the Great, mother of prostitutes and of earth's abominations. And I saw the woman drunk with the blood of the saints, the blood of the martyrs of Jesus. Okay. So, one of the angels that had the seven bowls now turns into a tour guide. And the angel comes and says to John, he is going to show John the great whore. So John is taken in the spirit into the wilderness, kind of a place of safety and a place of perspective, you know, somewhere you can get a good view of what's going on from. And from there in the wilderness, he sees the woman and the beast. John writes that he sees a great whore who is seated on many waters. And we're going to learn that this is the city of Rome. Back in the Old Testament, the prophets sometimes referred to cities as prostitutes. For example, in Ezekiel 27, the city of Tyre was called a prostitute. So this idea of labeling a city as a whore is not new to John. The city seated on many waters in the Old Testament was a reference to Babylon, but now it's a reference to Rome. The reference being the city of Rome, you know, now has this empire seated on the entire Mediterranean Sea and then some. So the city seated on many waters is Rome. And Rome is described as a drunken prostitute. She is dressed in purple and gold, and she's adorned with much jewelry, and from a distance, she probably looks fairly attractive. But in her hand, she has a golden cup, and it's a cup filled with sewage, with abomination and impurities, and she is in this drunken stupor. Rome rides on a beast, a scarlet beast with seven heads and ten horns. It's the Roman Empire. Rome rides on the Roman Empire. Okay. Interesting image. What John is doing here is writing political satire. It's political satire. Rome and its propaganda very often described itself in terms of Romana, who was the mother goddess. Huh? And so Rome described herself in terms of the mother goddess. Rome said she was the great city from which the rest of the world could orientate itself. And now John says, don't believe it. Rome isn't a mother. Rome isn't a goddess. Rome isn't a point of orientation. She's a whore. She's an absolute whore. What John is trying to do is unmask Rome for his readers. He kind of wants to pull back the veil and let people see Rome for what it really is. Remember in the Wizard of Oz movie, you know, the Great Oz, and they pull back the screen and there's the scrawny little guy moving all these levers? That's what John wants to do with Rome. Rome portrays herself as this goddess, as this mother city, as the center for the universe, and John says, uh-uh. He's pulling back the veil and showing Rome for what it really is. And again, the reason, Christians in places like Laodicea and Sardis were tempted to accommodate themselves to Rome. And so what John is saying is, don't accommodate yourself to Rome. She's a whore. She's a prostitute. He's trying to portray Rome so negatively that Christians will instinctively recoil against Rome. I don't know if you can see, see that. This is a wood carving that was done by an artist, Albrecht Dürer, who did some marvelous stuff on Revelation. Dürer lived about the same time as Martin Luther. He's got a woman with a golden cup sitting on a seven-headed beast. And it's a wood carving of chapter 7. So one of the things that John is doing is using symbols to bring us to a deeper understanding of reality. I think sometimes one of the ways Revelation is proclaimed is that Revelation uses code language, you know, so that the Romans can't figure out what John is writing. You know, one of the theories is John writes in code so the Romans don't understand. And I don't think that's true. Some of John's symbols are so obvious that even the dumbest of Romans would have figured it out. What John is really doing is using symbols in the opposite direction. He's using symbols to help us understand the nature of things. And so he calls Rome a prostitute to help us understand the real nature of Rome. The reason for John's symbolic language is to give us insight into what Rome really is. And so where, you know, in the real world, you look at Rome and it kind of looks gray, there's some good, there's some bad. John uses some very stark imagery to go black and white. You know, Rome is lousy. So his use of symbols is to help us see the real nature of Rome. By the way, notice how John uses his image. Back in chapter 12, the people of God have been portrayed as a glorious woman. Now Rome is portrayed as a prostitute. In chapter 19, the women of the people of God will be portrayed as a bride. He's using very stark language to help us see the true nature of things. Okay? You okay with that? Questions on that? John doesn't like Rome. You kind of get that impression. Well, continuing on then in 18, let me read the rest of the chapter, beginning with verse 7 there. When I saw her, I marveled greatly. But the angel said to me, why do you marvel? I will tell you the mystery of the woman and of the beast with seven heads and 10 horns that carries her. The beast that you saw was and is not, and is about to rise from the bottomless pit and go to destruction. And the dwellers on earth whose names have not been written in the book of life from the foundation of the world will marvel to see the beast, because it was and is not and is to come. This calls for a mind with wisdom. The seven heads are seven mountains on which the woman is seated. They are also seven kings, five of whom have fallen. One is, the other has not yet come. And when he does come, he must remain only a little while. As for the beast that was and is not, it is an eighth, but it belongs to the seventh, and it goes to destruction. And the 10 horns that you saw are 10 kings who have not yet received royal power, but they are to receive authority as kings for 1 hour together with the beast. These are of one mind, and they hand over their power and authority to the beast, and they will make war on the Lamb, and the Lamb will conquer them, for he is Lord of lords and King of kings, and those who are called and chosen, those with those who are called and chosen and faithful. And the angel said to me, the waters that you saw where the prostitute is seated are peoples and multitudes and nations and languages. And the 10 horns that you saw, they and the beast will hate the prostitute. They will make her desolate and naked and devour her flesh and burn her with fire. For God has put into their hearts to carry out his purpose of being of one mind and handing over their royal power to the beast until the words of God are fulfilled. And the woman that you saw is the great city that has dominion over the kings of the earth. This section of 17 gets a little complicated, but the basic images are really clear. So it's not quite as bad as it looks. John begins by describing the beast as it was, and it is not, and it's about to ascend from the bottomless pit and go to destruction. It was, it isn't now, but it will come again. Couple of things John's doing there. One is he's referencing that Nero legend. Remember, Nero was the nutcase Roman emperor who had persecuted Christians, who committed suicide, but nobody really believed he was dead. And so there were rumors in the Roman Empire that Nero was coming again. And so he's referencing all of that stuff. In addition, he's doing a cute little wordplay there. He's saying that the Roman Empire was a beast, i.e. it did persecute Christians, which it did under Nero. It is not, it's not doing many persecutions now. The time Revelation was written, weren't a whole lot of persecutions, but it's coming again. And it's a warning that Rome's going to start persecuting Christians again. So when he's using this language of it was, is not, is to come, is to ascend from the bottomless pit, he's playing with Rome and saying, yeah, remember Rome did persecute Christians. You got a little reprieve right now, but don't let down your guard because the persecutions are going to start again. And he was absolutely correct. But it's John's way of describing the Roman Empire. Then in chapter 9, John tells us that there are the seven heads are seven mountains. What's the city on seven hills? Rome. I mean, that's one of those places, you know, even the dumbest of Roman guards would have figured that one out. You know, it's not a very convoluted symbol. It's very obvious. The city that he's referring to is the city of Rome. But then John's got to get a little more complicated. John likes images that can work in more than one way. And so if an image can work a couple of ways, John's just happy as a lark. So Rome has seven heads. That means it tells us that it's Rome. But then he goes on to say the seven heads also refer to seven kings, five of which have fallen, one is living, and one is yet to come. Okay, seven kings. Five have come, one now, one more to come. Students of Revelation read that and say, aha, what a great place to date Revelation, right? Revelation should be written during the reign of the sixth Roman emperor, right? I mean, shouldn't this be a great place to be able to date the book? If five emperors have happened, one's not, I mean, this should tell us at least what emperor was ruling when John wrote. But of course, it's not that simple. We don't know where John would have started his count. You know, would he have started with Julius Caesar, who became emperor? Would he have started with Caesar Augustus, who was the first full-time emperor? Would he have started with Nero, who was the first emperor to persecute Christians? Also, if you go through Roman history, there's a bunch of emperors who rule a very short time. You know, literally a couple of months. And so we don't know if John would have included those or not. So it's really not much help in dating and figuring out who the emperor was. But if you think about it, John really didn't need to put together anything to tell who the Roman emperor was. His original audience knew that. John didn't have to come up with some kind of riddle so people could figure out who the Roman emperor was. It's kind of like, you know, if I'm preaching later on today and I come up with a riddle so you guys can figure out who the American president is. Well, you don't need much of a riddle to do that. You probably got a pretty good idea of who's in charge, whether you like him or not. You know who the president is. Likewise, John doesn't have to tell a riddle so people can figure out who the emperor is. They already know. More likely, John is playing with some of his imagery, And so the seven emperors, seven being a number of completeness, refers to the complete line of emperors, however many that's going to be. And the eighth emperor who returns, one of the seven who returns, probably another reference to the Nero letter, our legend. So probably not a good place to date him. John then talks about ten horns, who are explained as ten kings who will receive authority and ally themselves with Rome. Do any of you remember when the European Common Union was formed? Remember when that happened? There were initially 12 members of the European Common Union, and Revelation folks freaked. They just absolutely panicked and said, "Ha! Here comes the 10 kings, you know, that are coming together to, you know, to fulfill Revelation 17, and Armageddon must be just around the corner." And I mean, there were folks that were really very much against the European Common Union because of all this. Well, they found out very quickly it wasn't a good way to read Revelation, because very quickly the European Common Union grew beyond 10 members, so it had absolutely nothing to do with that. And I don't know that we should take any of that too literally. You know, we've already discovered when John uses numbers and symbols, he's usually pretty creative about it. Moreover, he says these 10 horns are 10 kings who ally themselves with Rome, and they rule for 1 hour. Well, yeah, it's kind of a short period of time. I probably wouldn't take that too literally. What I do think, the reason he comes up with 1 hour, in the next chapter, when John talks about, in chapter 18, about Rome being destroyed, in John's visionary world, he writes about Rome being destroyed in an hour. And so when he talks about these people aligning themselves with Rome, he uses the hour figure. He's providing some continuity in his vision. So some of this imagery in chapter 17 gets confusing, but I think the points are clear. The point is, the Roman Empire will be allied, will get some allies. There will be a bunch of people that will align themselves with Rome, and they will fight against the Lamb. They will oppose Jesus. They will not succeed. Then comes the clincher. Moreover, the beast and the 10 kings, the Roman Empire and the 10 kings, will turn on the whore. They'll turn on Rome. Rome's very allies and empire will destroy her. And I think there's a profound insight there. What John is saying is that evil ultimately self-destructs. That which is evil cannot create that which is good and lasting, because evil by its very nature is destructive. It is God who creates, it is God who gives life. When that which is opposed to God acts, it's always going to self-destruct. And so what he's saying is the Roman Empire, being evil, all this eventually is going to turn in on itself and self-destruct. And by the way, notice how that self-destruction fits God's purpose. God's purpose is that evil be stopped. Well, evil will take care of that for God. Evil will self-destruct. So, chapter 17. Again, the imagery gets a little bit convoluted, but I think basically John is making two very clear points. Number one, Rome is a whore. And so Christians, do not align yourself with Rome. Do not accommodate yourself to Roman ways. Don't accommodate yourself to Rome. And second, evil will self-destruct. Evil will self-destruct. Don't trust that which is evil, because ultimately it's going to cave in on itself. Let me stop it. Do you agree? That's kind of a cool insight. Is it the case that evil is going to self-destruct? You know, I think historically you could make some arguments for that. There have been a whole lot of evil empires, and sooner or later, they reap the seeds of their own destruction. Yeah. So I think John's onto something there. Good. Questions on that? Comments? Yeah, it actually, it's kind of a nice insight. That which is not of God, do not trust and do not build on, because it's not going to last. It is finally only God who gives life to the world. It's finally only God who creates and deepens. But I would agree with it.
The what is the evil thing right now in today that we can look for?
Yeah, yeah. And I think when people read Revelation, they either get locked in the past and they say, okay, the beast was Rome. Rome disappeared, what, 1,500, 1,600 years ago. This is, you know, you don't have to worry about this. Or we get very futuristic and say somewhere in the future, God's going to send a horrible person's going to arise and destroy the world. But that's not here yet. So, it's you know, we either go to the past or the future and it doesn't say anything to us. I would think a better way to read Revelation is to ask the question, what looks beastly in our day? Huh? What's evil in our day? Because one of the things Revelation is saying is that evil will always try to make itself look good. It would be wonderful if that which is evil would jump out with a nice little sign saying, hey, I'm evil, and I'm out to get you. And it never does that. Evil always makes itself look good. You know, my most obvious example is Adolf Hitler. You know, how did he get to office? He was elected. He was the one who was going to straighten out the German state. Didn't come out saying, I'm going to try to massacre, you know, 11 million people in a Holocaust. I'm going to restore Germany to its former grandeur. Well, turns out he was evil. Evil always makes itself look good. And I think, what is one Revelation scholar says, the job of the church is to name the beast. The job of the church is to name the beast. What in our world looks beastly? If Satan is still active, Satan is still raising up beasts today. I think the question Revelation drives for me is, what's beastly in our world? And where do we accommodate it? You know, are there beastly things in our world that we're very comfortable accommodating ourselves with? Maybe an example from American history, Jim Crow laws, you know, in this country for years. You know, we had laws that put blacks in second place. And I think, by and large, a lot of Christians accommodated themselves to that. You know, it was a beast. You know, are there things in our modern culture, in our day, that's beastly? And I think that becomes the good question of Revelation. You know, so what does this mean? Secure that God will ultimately win the battle. What do we have to be on guard for now? And that's, so I think that's helpful.
What about our addiction to social media now?
You see, I think you could have some fun with that. Is social media ultimately good or bad? I'm not so sure. Yeah, I'm not so sure. And does it self-destruct well with some of the privacy issues and some of the stuff it's getting into? Yeah, I mean, that. My favorite response to what looks beastly in our society is Hollywood. I mean, I just think that, I mean, it looks glamorous. It makes itself look glamorous. It seeks to be a point from which the world orientates itself. And man, some of the values that are spewed out of there are, as John would say with the whore, the raw sewage. Hollywood? Social media? I mean, what is Satan using? So I very good question.
Where would you put this device? Good.
Yeah, I was going to say the cell phone. Yeah, I wrestle with the, I wrestle with that in my own life. And there are, there are things I love about cell phones. I mean, if there's an emergency, people can get a hold of me real quick. If I get a checkup on my kids, I can do it real quick. And there's stuff I hate about cell phones. And then I find out people are getting information off of my cell phones. I mean, somebody out there in cyberspace knows more about me than I do. You know, so, yeah, technology. Good. Any more on that? If not, let's jump into 18. And time for a little more on Rome falling. Chapter 18 is one of the most artistic chapters in the book. I mean, it's beautifully and powerfully written. Chapter 18 is basically a funeral dirge. It's an account and a lamenting of the destruction of Rome. And so it's basically a dirge from a funeral, lamenting what's happened to Rome. In fact, watch in chapter 18 how the destruction of Rome is not portrayed directly. What John does is he portrays people watching the destruction of Rome. And so he focuses on the witnesses who are seeing Rome described over here. He doesn't talk about Rome's annihilation directly. He focuses on those who are watching Rome get annihilated. It's a beautiful artistic move and really a powerful way of getting at all that. Also, as you read chapter 18, notice the changing tenses. When I was in seventh grade, I had Mr. Slater for English, and he was bound and determined when we wrote a paragraph, it would all be in the same tense. You know, that you don't go past, present, future, you keep that. And John obviously didn't have Mr. Slater for English or Greek or whatever language John was writing in. John is just tenses all over. So verse 2, Rome is depicted as fallen. It's happened already. And then in verse 4, John comes back and says, get out of Rome because she's going to fall. I mean, there's no continuity. The tenses change all through the chapter. But it also tells you really can't put this on a timeline. I think John's point is not so much to give us a historical prediction of the end of Rome as to tell Christians to get away from the seducing power of Rome. Be careful with Rome. Get some distance between you and her. So it's real artistic. Let's do a little bit with this. Chapter 18, after this I saw another angel coming down from heaven, having great authority, and the earth was made bright with his glory. And he called out with a mighty voice, fallen, fallen is Babylon the Great. She has become a dwelling place for demons, a haunt for every unclean spirit, a haunt for every unclean bird, a haunt for every unclean and detestable beast. For all nations have drunk the wine of the passion of her sexual immorality, and the kings of the earth have committed immorality with her, and the merchants of the earth have grown rich from the power of her luxurious living. So this bright angel, this angel bright with splendor, comes and announces that Rome has fallen. And it's stark, horrifying language. Rome has become the dwelling place of demons and foul birds and hateful beasts. Rome is gone. She's gone. And then he goes on and says, people, get away from her. Verse 4, then I heard another voice from heaven saying, come out of her, my people, lest you take part in her sins, lest you share in her plagues, for her sins are heaped high as heaven, and God has remembered her iniquities. Pay her back as she herself has paid back others, and repay her double for her deeds. Mix a double portion for her of the cup she mixed, as she glorified herself and lived in luxury, so give her a like measure of torment and mourning. Since in her heart she says, I sit as a queen, I am no widow, I am no widow, and mourning I shall never see. For this reason her plague shall come in a single day, death and mourning and famine. She will be burned up with fire, for mighty is the Lord God who judges her. Here ends the reading of the good news. Another voice now comes and says, come out of her, my people. That's a paraphrase of Jeremiah 51. Jeremiah has used similar language back in the Old Testament. Come out of her, my people. The call is not to physically move from Rome. It's not a call to physically move to the suburbs. It's a call for Christians to distance themselves from Roman ways. Christians, come out of her. Don't accommodate yourself. Rome is doomed. Don't participate in her. Question, as we're going through all this judgment on Rome, why is Rome being judged? What's Rome done that's so bad? John certainly doesn't like her. Yeah, what has Rome done that's so bad?
Worshipped idols,
worshipped emperors, turned its rulers into gods. That's the first commandment doesn't agree with that very nicely.
I'd say she represents the antithesis of what Christ is trying to.
I was going to say. Yeah.
Everything is opposite.
Everything opposite. Here's what Christ is trying to do with his world. Here's what Rome's trying to do with the world. And they're polar opposites. Yeah. They just can't coexist. They contradict each other. One's got to go. Good.
And it was the dominant government at the
I was going to say, ruled with force, ruled with violence. Yeah, it was. And Rome did some good things. This is the Pax Romana, historically. There's trade, there's a rule of law, there's all that, but boy, it comes at a price. It comes at a steep, steep price. There was a scholar named Adela Collins who worked on this, Adela Yarbrough Collins. And she wrote a chapter in one of her books on why is Rome judged, and I like what she comes up with. In the first place, Roman judge is judged because of the idolatrous and blasphemous worship offered and encouraged by Rome, especially the emperor cult. The fornication that John refers to is the worship of emperors. When you start referring to your leaders as Lord and God, when your coins, instead of saying "In God we trust," say "Domitian, Lord and God," that's fornication. John is very clear, worship is to be reserved only for God. Second problem, the violence perpetrated by Rome, especially against Jews and Christians. Rome has shed the blood of Christians. John expects Rome to shed more Christian blood. And I think we can expand on that and say, not only is Rome guilty of the blood of prophets and saints, but of all who have been slaughtered on the earth. Behind Roman power and glory is violence. And John condemns that. Number three is interesting to me. Rome's blasphemous self-glorification. Gary, it's kind of what you were saying. Rome in arrogance saw herself as the center of the world. Rome really saw itself as the point from which the world should orientate itself. And John is saying that position is to be reserved only for God. It is only God who serves as the orientation for life. And then finally, fifth one, Roman wealth. Rome's emphasis on wealth and luxuries is condemned here in chapter 18. I think that's a pretty good list. I think that actually rings pretty true. And then the question Revelation raises for me is, are we guilty of any of these? any of these hit a little close to home? Yeah, that's. And I think that's where Revelation becomes so powerful. That we don't just use it as a bazooka to shoot at all those sinners out there, but we rather dare stand in front of it and say, okay, if this is what John is condemning, you know, do we participate in any of that? And where would Revelation correct us? Well, let's finish up the chapter here. And again, very artistic chapter. Beginning with verse 9, three different groups are now going to mourn for Rome. The kings of the earth, the merchants, and the shipmasters are all going to mourn. Verse 8, and the kings of the earth who committed sexual immorality and lived in luxury with her will weep and wail over her when they see the smoke of her burning. They will stand far off in fear of her torment and say, "Alas, alas, you great city, you mighty city Babylon, for in a single hour your judgment has come." The kings who have shared in Rome now weep for their loss. And the grief is very self-centered. I mean, Rome has been their source of power and wealth. Rome is destroyed. They're in trouble. And so they're mourning Rome, but it's a very self-centered, grief. The merchants of the earth now mourn, and beginning in verse 11, and again, very self-centered. And the merchants of the earth weep and mourn for her, since no one buys their cargo anymore. Cargo of gold, silver, jewels, pearl, fine linen, purple cloth, silk, scarlet cloth, all kinds of scented wood, all kinds of articles of ivory, all kinds of articles of costly wood, bronze, iron and marble, cinnamon, spice, incense, myrrh, frankincense, wine, oil, fine flowers, wheat, cattle and sheep, horses and chariots, slaves, that is, human souls. The fruit for which your soul longed is gone from you, and all your delicacies and your splendors are lost to you, never to be found again. The merchants of these wares who gained wealth from her will stand off in fear of her torment, weeping and mourning aloud. Alas, alas, for the great city that was clothed in fine linen and scarlet and purple, adorned with gold, with jewels and fine pearls, for in a single hour all this wealth has been laid waste. So now the merchants of the earth join in the lament over Rome. Notice that list of luxury items that's been supplied by them. I mean, that's pretty impressive. Rome has lived very glamorously. It is a very, very impressive list. I would also note in that list of items that the merchants have supplied, right at the end they mention slaves and human lives. John seems to be indicting the Roman use of slavery. And I highlight that because it's one of the few places in the Bible where slavery is indicted. You know, normally the Bible doesn't take on slavery. This is one place where John lifts it up and indicts it as something that is not in accord with God's plan. But again, all this grieving is self-centered. You know, we got rich through Rome. Now we've lost the source of our wealth. And then finally, some shipmasters and seafaring men jump in. And all the shipmasters and seafaring men, sailors and all whose trade is on the sea stood far off, whose cry and cried out as they saw the smoke of her burning. What city was like the great city? And they threw dust on their heads as they wept and mourned, crying out, "Alas, alas, for the great city, where all who had ships at sea grew rich by her wealth. For in a single hour she has been laid waste. Rejoice over her, O heaven, and you saints and apostles and prophets, for God has given judgment against her." So now the seafarers join in the grieving. Now the end of the chapter. And notice in these last verses, listen for a little bit of grief in John's voice. Listen for a little bit of grief as John writes. Verse 21. Then a mighty angel took up a stone like a great millstone and threw it into the sea, saying, "So will Babylon, the great city, be thrown down with violence and will be found no more. And the sound of harpists and musicians, of flute players and trumpets will be heard in you no more. And a craftsman of any craft will be found in you no more. And the sound of the mill will be heard in you no more. And the light of a lamp will shine in you no more. And the voice of bridegroom and bride will be heard in you no more. For your merchants were the great ones of the earth, and all nations were deceived by your sorcery. And in her was found the blood of the prophets and the saints, and of all who have been slain on the earth." So a great angel comes, heaves this great millstone, and says, "With such violence will the great city of the earth be thrown down." And again, a listing of things that will be lost. Do you hear a little bit of grief in John's voice? I mean, there's a little bit of sadness in John. And the musicians will be heard no more, and flute players and trumpets and craftsmen will be found, and the sound of a mill will be heard in you no more. John, I think, is acknowledging is there was good in Roman culture. You know, Rome produced some very good things, some wonderful things. And all that's going to go. All that's going to go. I think there's some grief in John. I got a quote that I love. It's from an interpreter of Revelation named Fred Craddock. And he summarizes this chapter by saying, "Rome has fallen, to be sure. But the poet," namely John, "but the poet walks among her ruins, feeling the weight of the loss and singing God's victory with a heavy heart." Isn't that nice? Rome has fallen, to be sure, but the poet walks among the ruins, feeling the weight of the loss and singing God's victory with a heavy heart. I mean, John's a realist. Rome's got to go, but it doesn't mean everything in Rome was bad. And so John is kind of mixed. He's grieving, grievingless as he moves forward. So anyway, that's chapter 18. Rome has been judged. Questions or comments or? I don't think I'm going to start on 19 today. I think I'll save that for next week. With 19, we really get into some of the end of Revelation stuff. That's kind of a section unto itself. So
it's scary how this parallels what's happening to us. It's just too coincidental.
One of the things that has terrifies me about Revelation is when I look at what's going on in Rome's civilization. That sounds a little parallel to our culture, doesn't it? I mean, Rome started out as a republic, you know, and I think did some good things. But along the way, it gets itself corrupted to the point that it gets destroyed. And you know, does any of that fit with our culture? And if it does, then how do we get off this track? Because Rome, Ed.
This talks about millstones, and Jesus talked about a millstone tied around somebody's neck could be better off.
Yeah.
If he's been abusing one of these children.
Yeah.
Is there any connection between millstones?
Symbol of judgment. I mean, it's a big, heavy. Big heavy rocks, the idea of a millstone being thrown at you or hung around your neck, it's a very stark symbol of judgment. So he's New Testament makes use of that.
Well, John may have heard Jesus say.
Maybe some references to Jesus preaching, yeah. 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 Do you see any parallels in this with us?
Everything.
Yeah. There was actually a... Harry Wentz is one of my favorite biblical scholars, but he likes to point out when at the time in the American Revolution, there was an English historian who wrote, "It's not going to last," that this American experiment in democracy will not last, and he had researched previous empires, previous countries, and his research indicated that democracy had about a 200-year shelf life. And then what would happen after about 200-300 years is people would begin realize they quit focusing on building the nation and began focusing on the fact that they could vote themselves privileges. We're a democracy, right? We can vote ourselves extra privileges, take care of ourselves, and when that happens, then eventually the democracy collapses. And this historian wrote, the American experiment is nice, it's got about 200 years, and you know that's how it's going to last. And I read that and said, whoa, I mean, it's been a little over, we're pushing 300 years, but, you know, have we done that? We've realized we can vote ourselves more privileges, we can have more social spending on our, and we get to the point where we can't afford it. There's just some basic economics there. You can't keep outspending, you know, what you're taking in.
That day was long ago.
What's that?
$20 trillion in debt. I think we've been doing it a long time.
Yeah, we're in that. And so, what do you do about that? What do you? Mm. Yeah, Gary.
I'm trying to figure out how to say this. She says don't.
Yeah, I'll go for it. Yeah, yeah.
You know, I feel the values. There's a conflict between trying to assimilate religion into our secular society. Mm-hmm. So what I observe in a lot of things I'm reading is if you are a Christian and have Christian beliefs, there's folks who are pejorative about that and look down upon you because you ought to be secular and worldly.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're Christian, they imply that you don't accept everybody.
Mm-hmm.
But you have a certain set of beliefs that are antithetical to others.
Yeah.
And I don't believe that.
Yeah.
But that's what so many people on the left and right coasts
are arguing.
Think about the rest of us. And they're trying to take religion out of society totally.
Yeah.
Which breaks down to me on moral structure, for example, Hollywood, promoting all of that.
Yeah.
I see that as a real danger going forward
for
us as Christians on how we stand up for our belief. I mean, that's Rome had their own beliefs, and they didn't want
to. Contrary to
Christians come in with theirs.
Yeah, yeah. There've been a lot, and I'm not a political scholar, but there's been a lot written about what. In fact, there's a book by John Newhouse, "The Naked Public Square." You go back a generation, there was always a public square at the center of town. You know, there was kind of the center of the town, and his thing was, for many years there was a kind of a consensus of values in the country. There were basic values that were agreed upon. And he said, we've reached a pluralistic time now where we don't have that consensus of values. And his question was, can any society move forward without a consensus of values? If you're not going in the same direction, you're going to get anywhere. And I think it's a fair question. I think it's a really, really fair question.
Kind of there.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
I'm trying to define what defines our culture in the United States.
And yeah.
Got to be a lot of shared experiences. I mean, coming out of the education world, there's certain cultural things that we just assume, I think all of us in this room mm-hmm. probably have experienced. Yeah. And I don't see that in today's young people.
Yeah.
There was an editorial, it's been a year or more ago, talking about freshmen going into college and saying two books that are important for anybody in America to have read are works by Shakespeare, which is certainly mm-hmm. focusing on that. Mm-hmm. But the other was the Bible. Mm-hmm. Because there's so much in our culture that reference biblical mm-hmm. teachings, yeah. comments, and so forth.
Yeah.
Our kids aren't getting that.
Aren't getting that. Yeah.
And I don't know what they're getting.
What they're getting. What's yeah. Yeah. And so then what unifies the vision? What defines the culture? What defines the nation? And I think, yeah. I think we wrestle with that. Yeah. Yeah. I was in Israel. It's been a number of years ago now. But one of the things that struck me in Israel was the Israelis generally had a sense of we are doing this for the next generation. You know, if we're going to suffer, you know, we got to pay a lot of taxes to keep our military strong. Da 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 da. Anyway, but we're doing this for the next generation. You know, it's not about us; it's about moving forward. And coming back, I don't hear that as much in our country. You know, it's about how am I going to get my benefits? You know, how can I start getting my benefits rather than we're building something for our kids and grandkids? And it's,
don't you think that's because they're living under a constant threat, though?
Yeah.
And they have been for yeah. generations.
I was going to say, they have to live with that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
One of my Jewish friends told me once that, you know, he was very frugal with his money. Of course,